Welcome to the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast, the show where brilliant professionals share how to sharpen the universal skills required to flourish at work, enjoy more career fun, wins, meaning, and money with your host, Pete Makaitis.
Hello, and thanks so much for joining us here for episode 276 with Alex Grodnick. I think you'll enjoy this conversation because Alex is talking about how to not take no for an answer in the best, most uplifting possible way. And this was a great topic back in episode 16 with Andrea Waltz when she talked about going for no. And I think it's worth talking again because I just love the way Alex reframes it in such a cool way. So you'll learn one, why no is not the end, but only the beginning. Two, the prescription to overcome your fear of rejection. And three, how to reframe the no. So if you'd like to check out the show notes or the transcript or the links to items that we reference here, it's over awesomeatyourjob.com/F276. And while you're at awesomeatyourjob.com, I encourage you to check out some of our handy resources. One I'll point to is the 10 Days to Winning at Work email course, which is a collection of excerpts from my enhanced thinking and collaboration training programs, which have been shown to, on average, slash about 86 minutes of waste per person per week out of there. So you can get home early or do some more cool stuff you never get the chance to do because you're always in the day-to-day urgent fire drill stuff. Head over to awesomeatyourjob.com. So now, here's Alex's story. Alex began his career as an analyst at J.P. Morgan Private Bank. And after completing that program, he moved into investment banking at Houlihan Lokey in their restructuring group. Alex went on to work at a pioneering digital media firm before getting his MBA at UCLA Anderson. And Alex grew up in Park City, Utah, and loves to ski and golf. Here is Alex. Alex, thanks so much for joining us here on the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast.
Pete, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Oh, me too. And I think we've got a lot of great stuff to cover. But first, I want to get your take on. I've learned that you had the idea for Uber years before the Uber people founded Uber. What's the story here?
Yeah, so I was actually really fortunate. I got to grow up in Park City, Utah, which for those of you that don't know is a small ski town about 30 miles outside of Salt Lake. It's where all of the 2002 Winter Olympics skiing events were held. So, you know, it's a little ski town. Everything just revolves around skiing. And once a year there's also happens to be Sundance Film Festival in February. And so growing up there with Sundance, it's a fun time. There would be hundreds of thousands of people, of you know, movie stars and Hollywood people that would come to Park City. And it was kind of a unique period. And so going to high school there, I saw, man, my little town doesn't really have the infrastructure built to have hundreds of thousands of people here at a given time. And one of the things I saw is that there's no taxi system. There's no way for anyone to get around. So I had this idea, hey, my mom has an SUV. What if I turned her car into a taxi during Sundance for the 2 weeks that Sundance happened? And so I went to Home Depot and I got some fluorescent letters that said taxi. And I put them, you know, on the side of the car, on the back of the car. And also my dad did some work with police in one of his prior careers. And so we had one of those like undercover spinning lights that you plug into your cigarette lighter and like, you know, it magnets to the top of your car.
Oh, wow.
And completely illegal, but would absolutely blind people when they saw it, but would definitely get people's attention. So I'm armed with fluorescent taxi letters all over the car and this spinning red police light. And I set out into Park City and I'm picking people up. And it wasn't even 30 seconds before I picked my first person up. And they were from England and they got in the car and I drove them somewhere 5 minutes away. And they said, okay, how much do we owe you? And I kind of froze and I was like, ooh, I hadn't really thought about how to charge. So I said, well, you can just give me a tip. And they gave me $20.
There you go.
And I said, wow, I just made $20 for driving someone, you know, for about 5 minutes in my car. Maybe there's something to this. And it didn't stop from there. For the first probably 6 hours, I maybe had like 95% utilization, just dropping someone off, picking the next person up. Because there were no cars for anyone to take. So I came home on that first night about 8 o'clock. My parents were out to dinner. And my brother, I was like 17 at the time, and I think my brother was probably 13. And my brother's there, and I roll out, you know, must have been like $600 or $700 on the floor. And he and I are like rolling around in it, like we're Richie Rich. And I'm like, man, Jake, like there's something to this. And so I go back out, and I'm driving down Main Street of my town with this light spinning and says taxi all over my car. And before you know it, the police pull me over. And they're like, you know, where's your business license? Where's your regular license? What are you doing here? And I'm like, you know, I go to high school here. I'm not trying to do this. And they're like, just stop doing this. This is ridiculous. You can't do any of these things. You can't, I mean, you have an illegal police light. You're saying taxi. So I go home and I'm like, man, I have to keep this. I can't take a no here. So I went back to Home Depot and I got some letters that said free rides taxi and took off the light, still going around town doing this. And then I got pulled over again and they said, you can't say taxi. You're not a taxi. You don't have a business license. So fine, got rid of the taxi, still say free rides. And it did nothing to deter demand. So for the next 2 weeks, I'm driving nonstop after school, driving till 3-4 in the morning, picking people up. I got three of my friends involved in it. They took their parents' SUVs and they slapped free rides on it. And we had kind of a militia of high school students driving people around town. And, you know, now fast forward to today, Uber actually brings in a bunch of cars and, you know, there's Ubers in Park City and they bring in a bunch of stuff for the festival. But when I did this, there was nothing. And so it's kind of like, I always, I'll bump into some police or something when I go back to Park City and kind of everyone remembers this story.
Well, that's fun. Well, so with the militia, then you had multiple cars doing numerous nights unimpeded by the police once you called it free rides.
Yeah, that was it. I mean, I still got pulled over one more time and, they took about a half hour and they came back to us and they said, okay, just be safe.
Yeah,
that was a complete loophole.
Oh well, that's fun and intriguing, and well, I love it. So it's not just like you thought of it; you really took some action, and that's pretty cool. And I only thought of the Airbnb concept before Airbnb existed, and I had a buddy make a little PowerPoint talking about what he thought it would take to get the software up and going. And we're like, oh, that's kind of cool. Maybe later. So that's cool. Take it action. That's awesome. And so I want to talk in large part about you and not taking no, sort of as you illustrated here. But first, I want to get a little bit of context prior to. So you got Wall Street Oasis, and that is a website I've been to many times. But could you orient folks? What's the site about it, and what's your new podcast there about?
Yeah, absolutely. So Wall Street Oasis is a big finance community on the website, on the internet. It's been around for over 10 years, and it's one of the most active finance communities online. It gets about 1 million unique visitors per month, with people coming there looking for topics like how to break into investment banking, how to study for the GMAT, industry group-specific stuff within investment banking, private equity, hedge funds. It's pretty much the go-to place for people beginning a finance career. And recently, we've launched a podcast. And so the way that I came to it is I just graduated from business school. I got my MBA from UCLA and I started a podcast and the guys at Wall Street Oasis heard it. They liked it. And they said, why don't you just have your podcast come live on our site? And so for the last 6 months, we've been having a podcast where we speak with really just influential business leaders. Most of them are in finance, but a lot aren't. And we talk about secrets to success, the ups, the downs, optimal career paths, and really just life in general with founders, people like the CEO and founder of Google Voice, investment bankers who love investment banking, people who used to work in investment banking and have left for entrepreneurial pastures or greener pastures, all sorts of just interesting human stories.
Intriguing. So optimal career paths. Have you sort of synthesized any kind of key takeaways or themes that show up again and again when it comes to getting an optimal career path?
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. A lot of the kind of the key takeaways from the podcast kind of come congealed to one of them is like really finding the right people who compliment you. And that was something that Craig Walker, he's the guy who founded Google Voice and who now has been a serial entrepreneur. But, you know, he attributes a lot of the success that he's had in his career to positioning himself around just other smart people, people that complement his skill sets. And, you know, we've also had discussions about, you know, the importance of networking with your peers and not just networking with the guys who are running the show, but networking with your peers can be as beneficial as networking with bosses, because as you and your peers progress, they're eventually going to be the ones running the show. And so that's also super important. We talk about breaking down success and how defining success is really important and how putting a process around that. So lots of interesting tidbits that have come from the podcast, which has been really, really fun to do and get these firsthand.
That is cool. Yes. Well, so I'm intrigued when it comes to career paths. So I've been to Wall Street Oasis for all sorts of little questions. It seems like Google loves it. So, hey, that's cool. All sorts of questions. I remember when I was researching dress shoes, it seemed like many, many forum posts had to do with dress shoes and the hierarchy of prestige or quality to them. But I think a much more substantive question is when it comes to MBAs, Masters of Business Administration degrees, you got one. And you're thinking a lot about career paths and career advice. I know this is a hot topic. I know people who got an MBA and regret it, say, why did I spend that time and money? I know people who got an MBA and say, they were the best 2 years of my life. I figured out so much stuff. It's been so instrumental in opening doors. What's your take on that one?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a tough question. It's a unique question. It's different for every single person. And I think if you go to a top 30 program, right? I mean, there's 25, 30 great business schools, it's going to be very tough to regret it in the long-term picture. I mean, it is a action-packed, very, very fast-moving, fun couple of years. I mean, the experiences that you have are life-changing. The people that you meet are life-changing. But you're getting at a good point. It is expensive. You might be giving up. You know, look at my perspective. I gave up a job where I was making, you know, six figures for 2 years, and then you're paying six figures to go to school. So this is a huge, huge commitment. Really, on the financial return side, it makes a lot of sense if you come from a, I don't know, I'm going to call it obscure background, just not a traditional background or a traditional background, but you want to move into a different career path. So you want to go work for a big company. So say you want to go work for Bain or a different management consulting company or an investment bank or Amazon. Amazon was actually the number one recruiter out of my class. These are window jobs, and windows open up to get these jobs right after undergrad, and then they close. And then another window opens up again right after business school. And so if you want to go work for GE or Amazon or JP Morgan, great. You go to business school, you come into business school, you leave your job paying $80,000, $90,000, $100,000, and you get a job that pays you $200,000. And it's a pretty quick return on investment, right? From my perspective, I left a job paying me hundreds of thousands of dollars, and now I go to business school and I spent another $100,000, and now I'm at a job that's paying me literally hundreds of dollars per week. So my return is going to be a little bit longer, but there's no way that I regret going to business school. The connections and experiences that I had, I think, are going to be fruitful for me for my entire life. You know, I went to business school at UCLA. I plan on living my whole life in Los Angeles. So these connections, you know, the 50, 100 connections that I have are really going to, I think, prove beneficial for me throughout my career.
Okay, that's cool. Thank you. Well, one more appetizer, if I may, before we jump into the meat of things. And I would love to get your take. You know, bankers and finance folks, there are some associations and some stereotypes, whether they come from movies or the imagination of folk. So having lived it and seen a lot of commentary around it through Wall Street Oasis, what general tidbits might you share in terms of when it comes to banker perception and stereotypes? Which of them are generally true versus generally false versus really vary a whole lot person to person?
Yeah. So I did banking for a short time in New York, but mostly I did it in Los Angeles. And, you know, while investment bankers are pretty similar across, I mean, you're gonna have much more stereotypical investment bankers in New York than you are in LA. But, you know, just like anything else, stereotyping and grouping people is kind of a lazy way to look at it. You know, every single person's unique, but I can tell you that most investment bankers tend to be intelligent, driven, and bitter. You know, bitter after 1 year on the job, I would say. Optimistic, pie-eyed optimistic 0 years into the job, and then after 1 year, maybe a little bitter.
You always say bitter, like bitter about what or in what ways?
You know, it's tough. You have thought for so long that you want to do investment banking, and you get this job and really you're just elated and they're paying you lots of money. I mean, you make, you know, well into the $100,000 your first year out of undergrad, and you think, oh man, I'm going to go really just light the world on fire here. But then you start to realize that a big piece of that large compensation really is to compensate you for giving up your entire life. So you really have very, very little clarity into when you're going to be working and when you're not going to be working. I mean, basically, the idea is you're going to be working around the clock. I mean, there were, I can't tell you how many times there were when it's Friday at 5:30 and I'm thinking, yes, I am getting out of here. I'm going to go get dinner with my girlfriend. I text her, let's get dinner, cancel your plans. And 15 or 20 minutes later, it's, you got to make that terrible phone call where, hey, sorry, I actually got a bunch of work. And not only am I not going to see you tonight, I'm not going to see you tomorrow. I'm not going to see you Sunday either. And so that gets old. And, you know, investment banking, it's an incredible place to begin your career. They say it's like dog years. You get 7 years worth of experience for every 1 year of work. And it is, you learn a lot. You get incredible access to management teams and investors and boards of directors. And it's, you're at the top level of the capital structure, but you have to sacrifice a lot for it. And, it's definitely a trade-off that, you know, people are usually not fully aware of when they're making the decision to get into it.
Okay. Well, thank you. Well, cool. So now I've sort of scratched the itch of curiosity. I had a few things I wanted to hear you tackle. So now I want to hear a little bit about one of your superpowers, which is not taking no for an answer. What do you mean by that? And how can we implement some of this wisdom?
Yeah. I mean, what do I mean by not taking no? It's pretty simple. When someone tells you no, for me, that gets me excited because it's like, okay, now my skills and expertise get to shine. I get to find a creative way, a loophole, a workaround, just like I did with that taxi story at the beginning. But it's pretty much what my entire career has been based off of just not taking no in chasing, you know, the goals and accomplishments that you want to achieve. And so as applied in my life, you know, I got into a college that was kind of above my punching weight. Then I graduated from that college in 2009 and I got into investment banking right in the middle of the financial crisis, you know, and then I got a different job in investment banking. And now after business school, you know, I'm a first time entrepreneur. I've got a startup. We're raising venture financing for it. And I've been told no probably over 100 times trying to raise money for it. And it's exciting for me when that happens, because that's when you start to get creative.
Yeah, that's cool to hear. And there's so much to unpack there. When you say you heard no over 100 times, this is just bringing me back to when I wrote my first book. It was about leadership and student organizations. I wrote it in college. It's available for free at studentleadership.com, but not super relevant to what we're doing here. And it was interesting because I wrote all of these query letters, these one-page notes to publishers and agents. And like day after day after day, I would get a bundle of letters back in the mail, old-fashioned snail mail, that's saying no, no, no in differing sorts of ways. And occasionally they're like, yes, go ahead and send me a proposal. And one turned into a deal, which I ended up declining and self-publishing anyway. But it was very therapeutic for me in terms of saying, you know what? This doesn't really hurt or sting that much, hitting it again and again and again. And so you have called that rejection therapy. I don't know if that's an Alex original or if you're borrowing that from somewhere, but I love that turn of a phrase. Can you expand upon that?
Yeah. Yeah. Rejection therapy. It's not my phrase. It's out there in the public domain, but it's really just reducing the fear of rejection by exposure, by exposing yourself to it. You know, similar to someone who's afraid of germs. You're afraid of germs, and you go and you touch, you know, the railway going down to the subway in New York City every day. Over time, you're not going to be afraid of germs any longer. So it's desensitizing yourself to that fear. And it doesn't have to be big things. There's really only one rule to it, is that you need to be rejected by another person every day. And so really asking someone for a stick of gum or a ride across town or to borrow 50 cents or for a high five or to take a picture with you. All of these things in the beginning are hard to do. It's hard to ask someone for a stick of gum. By day five, by day six, by day seven, it's definitely not hard anymore. And all of a sudden, bigger things, asking for promotions at work or raises at your job or someone to go out on a date with you, become not hard. You become desensitized to being afraid of no.
That's great. That's a powerful thought there. And so I guess I'm wondering a little bit when it comes to all of this asking, is there a risk of becoming a taker, you know, in terms of you're just are freely asking and having so much fun with it that you're sort of receiving more than you're given out in the, I don't know, the professional or karmic context?
Yeah, of course there is. And you have to be mindful of that. I mean, we're all human beings. We all want things and we all generally like to help others. And so if you make it easy for someone to help you, that's usually a pretty good thing. And they're usually pretty amenable to doing that. On the same side, if someone asks you for something going through this process, you become more humble. There's a sense of humility that kind of comes over you as you go through this rejection process, because you start to see that really no one cares. Like if you ask someone for something you raise your hand in a class or you ask a question in a meeting, you might think it's a big deal, but everyone is really so concerned with themselves and so caught up in you know, what they're trying to get and their goals and their achievements, that no one's thinking about your silly question or something you asked them for. And so really you just come to the realization that it just doesn't matter. And by putting yourself out there, there's really only good to become from it. And yes, of course, you don't want to like be that guy that's, you know, asking and bothering people and pestering people. But, you know, there's a fine balance to it. And I'm sure the listeners of this podcast are smart enough to determine, you know, that balance for themselves.
Okay. And so now I want to zoom back to, you said when you hear a no, you get kind of excited. And so, and you said that's because it seems like it doesn't even register that this is the end or that the door has been closed to you, but rather you're being presented with an interesting challenge. Can you expand upon that a little bit in terms of, you know, what's going on in your brain and the emotional makeup when you hear the no?
Yeah. So there's obviously something missing inside. There's something amiss inside of me that I need to fill it up with, you know, challenges all day long. But, you know, that's a story for another podcast. But yeah, really, the interesting part is, okay, so you get told no, and to a lot of people, that's the end of it. To me, that's really the beginning of it, because now it's like, okay, my creative juices start to flow, and you get to think, how can I get around this? And so it's not even something that I'm doing consciously. It's just like the taxi story. It's, you tell me I can't have taxi on my car, and immediately my mind just says, free rides. I'm not, you know, afraid that the police have me pulled out of the car on the side of the street. I'm thinking, okay, how can I keep this going? How can I get around this? Very similar to what I told you about raising capital for the startup I'm working at. This is something I'm going through right now. You know, like I said, we've had hundreds of conversations, at least. No, 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 no. No at breakfast, no at lunch, no at dinner, no at cocktails. And I thought, okay, clearly there needs to be a better way to do this. And so I actually recently came up with a better way that I just started implementing. So I don't really have success metrics around it yet, but I've been asking a lot of these investors, instead of, hey, you know, can we have a meeting for the startup? I say, hey, do you want to be a guest on my podcast? And Pete, it's amazing. All of these big time major venture capitalists, they love talking about themselves and they want to be on the podcast. And so I say, hey, will you be on the podcast? And they say, oh my, I'm honored. I'd love to be on the podcast. Send me your startup deck. I'd love to look at that as well. It's like, it's incredible the results that we're seeing. You know, we went from like seeing like 10% success rates up to close to 40% success rates. And so it's early days. I don't have, you know, millions of dollars of funding to show for it yet, but invite me back in a few more months and I'm sure I will.
That's cool. Certainly. And I find that with the podcast analogy, well, it's not an analogy, the practice that you're employing, I can kind of relate to, in that it's really just so much a matter of, is your first kind of request or impression one in which you are giving, you're offering something versus you're taking something. And it's intriguing to me how, I suppose, when folks reach out to me with a guest pitch, like, hey, I want to be on your show, or I'm a publicist that I represent this client, I want to be on your show. It's like, you know, I'm automatically biased to saying no, because I don't know, 95%+ of those requests are just fall dead. So nice job, Alex. You got in. You're an elite 5% are there. So I was compelled, you know, that was because it was relevant and authoritative and engaging. And I'd heard of Wall Street Oasis, like, oh, cool. Yeah, let's talk. So that worked out. But on the flip side, if someone is kind of being generous, like, hey, would you like to appear on my podcast? Like, oh, well, yes, thank you. And then it's just sort of naturally inside me And vice versa is what I'm seeing. Robert Cialdini, author of Influence, would vouch for this. It's like there's this natural reciprocity. It's like, you know what? Someone gave me something and I'm inclined to say yes because, you know, it's beneficial for me. So sure, I'll say yes. And then as a result, I get to know that person. I've got a bit of a relationship with that person. I like that person, having had a little bit of a back and forth. And I kind of want to reciprocate. It's like, you know, that person was helpful to me. I feel like it would just only be right for me to, if possible, try a little harder to maybe find a potential fit in the podcast for them and to say, hey, this is what we're going for. You give me some topics. Those aren't any good. Give me some more time. You know, it's like suddenly, whereas they had to like nail it the first time with the perfect thing I needed to hear, now it's like I'm helping them. It's like, No, move it a little over this way so we could find a fit.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. It's reframing the no. And so it's beneficial to you. You know, I think Pitbull has this lyric in one of his songs where he says, you know, ask for money, get advice. Ask for advice, get money twice. And so, you know, really just repositioning, thinking creatively, instead of just asking, you know, what can you do for me? Maybe offering what you can do for them.
That's great. And could you give us a few more examples? So, you know, we've talked very specifically, you know, about, hey, if you happen to have a podcast or a media channel at your disposal, that's great. Go ahead and offer that up. But what are some other kind of gifts that you recommend offering that can help be door openers?
You know, like in terms of cold emailing people, there's kind of an art to it. And really, you have to be very clear with your ask. And so, when you're sending someone a cold note, you have to say, well, what am I looking for here? Yes, at the end of the day, I'm looking for a job, or, you know, I'm looking for an investment in my company. But there's sometimes 3, 4, 5, you know, maybe even 10 steps in between the cold email and the end goal. And so I like to take baby steps. And so the first email says, hey, can we have a 10-minute call? And if we're in the same city, hey, can we grab a 10-minute coffee? And really just by making it very, very simple and very clear, a very short email, I find that people are much more receptive to that. If you make it easy, you can have a calendar invite, you know, already in the email so that it's really straightforward and simple for them. And from there, you take the call and you turn it into an in-person meeting. You take the in-person meeting and you send them, you know, your investor deck or your business pitch. And you take that and you know, have them meet, you know, one of your co-founders or one of your advisors. And you know, it kind of snowballs from there. But you have to be very clear with your ask in the beginning and be very succinct with it as well.
Oh, that's good. That's good. So that's in the asking phase in terms of sort of upgrading folks' level of commitment and investment and helpfulness toward you. And I'd love to hear if you have a few more perspectives in terms of what you can give, what you can offer that is embraced, whether it's a media opportunity or what else.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. No one even asks the size of my podcast when I'm saying, hey, will you be on my podcast? So I mean, it's growing, and as I said, we've been doing it for 6 months now, but it could be an upstart, and I say, hey, come on my podcast, or hey, I'd love to interview you on my blog, or I would love to, you know, get a comment of yours on my Facebook channel. You know, there's really so many ways to engage someone today, and like I said, people are usually very interested in helping others. And they're also interested in talking and adding advice and talking about themselves, a common thing. Humans love talking about themselves. So if you can get them, instead of asking for what, you know, you might really want in step 6 or 7, just ask them for their advice, how they got to where they are, what they did. People are generally pretty receptive to that. And fine, if you have some type of outlet, you've got a Facebook channel, you've got a podcast, you've got a YouTube channel, people would be honored as they tell me to come on it and help you.
Absolutely. And so then I want to get your take then, when instead of maybe, let's say you don't get a no, but you just get silence, you know, it's sort of like if you try to make a call and it's a voicemail or an email or a letter, whatever your mechanism, a tweet, and there's just sort of nothing on the other end. In a way, I'm right with you. Like, oh, you hear a no and that sparks the creative wheels turning. Like, oh, okay, well, let's figure out an alternative win. You know, what happens if it's just sort of like you didn't even connect with them in the first place?
Yeah, and that's a great question, Pete. And that's probably the more common scenario. And what I tell you is what I tell, I mean, I tell my brother this. My brother is an actor. And I tell him about, you know, emailing people. And he does it sometimes. And he'll come back to me and say, you know, I emailed them and they didn't email me back. So forget them. That opportunity's dead. And I say, Jake, you sent them one email. Like, do you respond to every single email? You have to send them 2, 3, 4 emails. I mean, not, you know, every day, but like send an email, wait 8 or 9 days, send another email. Hey, just wanted to make sure you saw this. Would love to get your advice. Another week, week and a half. Hey, sorry for bothering you. This will be my last time. I would love to get your insight. And, you know, people are busy. They don't always respond to strangers on the first email, but give them the benefit of the doubt. They generally will respond if you send them, you know, a sequence of emails. And, you know, there's tools that you can help you to do this. Emailing tools like Mixmax is the one I use. And you can send an original email. And if they don't respond, you can set it for 7, 8, 9, 10 days later to send a follow-up email. But yeah, I mean, I say getting ghosted, you know, it's persistence. It's kind of also not taking no, but, you know, softly, not being a burden to someone.
Well, that's encouraging to hear that in your own life and results of emailing, you found that if you do have the persistence to do a triple over time, you say more often than not, you get something.
I'm not going to say more than 50%, so less often than not, but it's a numbers thing. If you send enough emails, and yes, you have, call it a 40% success rate over your 3-email chain, then yeah, those are pretty great numbers. I mean, cold emails in the world do not have a 40% success rate. I would assume they have like a low single-digit success rate. So if you can get above that, you know, by employing some of these tactics I'm talking about, then that's really great.
That's cool. And when is it time to say, you know, they've said no, and I've kind of come back with a number of creative alternatives. When is it time to say, you know, goodbye for now?
I would say, you know, sometimes like 3 contacts is probably enough. You don't really want to do more than that. And it's also not to say that that's dead. When you're playing these numbers games and you're sending, you know, a quantity of notes and emails and calls, sometimes things come back from the dead. You know, things from weeks and months old. Once you have enough irons in the fire, all of a sudden, like, old things start to come back alive. And it's really cool when that happens. It's an incredible testament to just, like, the effort and the dividends that it starts to pay over time.
Certainly. And I can admit and attest that when it comes to podcast guest pitches, I have pulled emails like months old because I saw them and I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. Okay, I'll put them in maybe I'll look at it later when, you know, the guest pipeline is looking a little light, bolder. And then when I do look at them closer and see some video, I go, oh, wow, what an engaging personality. Yeah, let's do it. So that totally happens on my end there. So very good. Well, tell me, Alex, anything else you want to make sure to cover before we shift gears and talk about some of your favorite things?
You know, I really just implore everyone to try the rejection therapy. It's pretty easy. Also, another great way to do it is when you go out, you know, and grab a turkey sandwich for lunch, you say, hey, may I please have a discount on this? And you will be amazed by how often you get 10% off of a turkey sandwich. And people love to do it. And it's kind of a funny thing, if, you know, because people aren't usually asked that. And so that's an interesting way to get it. But I really just want to leave with the saying that you'll never get what you don't ask for.
One easy way to enhance your giving side of the give and take Alex describes is answering your phone, just showing up to be able to serve. And a great resource to boost your answering consistency is AviConnect. AviConnect is the leading live receptionist service, which helps businesses screen, qualify, and convert incoming calls. Over 80% of callers who hit an answering machine hang up. So those lost calls mean lost business and opportunities to serve, and then in turn, ask. But it can be hard to answer your own phone every time with so many demands competing for your attention. AviConnect offers high-end call reception with super friendly staff to increase revenue and improve your customer's experience. They've got a real cozy family vibe about them that just leaves you feeling warm and fuzzy and wonderful when you get off the phone with them. I love just how fast and easy it was for me to get all set up with them. Their director of client relations, Marianne, was just a total peach and a lot of fun and made it so easy to do. So great experience there. AviConnect is offering us a zero obligation free trial. You can sign up today to make those missed opportunities history. And after the trial ends, you also get $95 off the first bill, but only if you sign up with our link, which is aviconnect.com/awesome. That's AviConnect.com/awesome. And I really appreciate you visiting aviconnect.com/awesome, because when you support our sponsors, you support my family, which means that I get to keep taking this time to keep making the show. So now let's hear some of Alex's favorite things.
That's true. Thank you.
Okay, well now could you share with us a favorite quote, something you find inspiring?
Yeah, I've got a bunch of quotes. Actually, I can remember the one from my childhood that was my favorite was, "The happiness of your life is based on the quality of your thoughts." And I really like that quote because it kind of goes with that, you know, happiness is a choice. It's not a right. It's not something that like you're automatically going to get. You need to choose to be happy and you need to seek that out in life. And so I make a conscious effort every day to remind myself that you can choose to be happy. And I also like a quote from Henry Ford where he says, "If you think you can or you think you can't, you're right."
And how about a favorite book?
You know, I just read Shoe Dogs, which was the Nike Phil Knight memoir. Just again, a story of persistence. Oh my God, the obstacles that he overcame in starting Nike. I mean, and not over a short period of time, basically over like 10 years, the fights with the manufacturing facilities in Asia and people trying to knock off his shoes and the retailers. I mean, it was endless. And he just kept going forward. So I really love that.
And how about a favorite tool, something that helps you be more awesome at your job?
Yeah, so I mentioned MixMax, which is the email and calendar sending tool. It's real simple. It's like, you know, one of these things where someone shares their calendar with you and they send you three or four different times and you click one and it instantly puts an appointment on both your calendars. It gets rid of the back and forth. You know, once someone agrees to meeting with you, you want to make it as easy as possible for them. And so by just quickly sending, you know, five or six different times where they can speak with you and not having to go back and forth with, "Hey, what works for you? Friday. All right. Well, how about the morning? No, I can't do the morning." Like, that sucks. So don't do that. Also, I recently purchased something for $8, which has changed my life. And it is computer glasses that I wear all day while staring at the screen that block some of the UV light from the computer screen. And you know, maybe this is just specific to me, but I would come home from work, you know, after staring at this computer screen for 10 hours, and like my eyes would be so strained and I would have a headache. I wear these $8 glasses and like I feel, my eyes feel like they do right when I wake up in the morning at the end of the day. So that's an interesting purchase too.
You know, these computer glasses have come up in a previous conversation when we were talking about sales, and then I had a listener say, "I love computer glasses." So it's striking a chord. So then what you're describing at $8 at the price point then sounds like it is primarily a matter of just blocking the light and not giving you any sort of prescription eye correction love, just a bit of UV or blue light blocking.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I don't wear glasses. If I did, I would get these lenses put in them, and I'm sure you can get these types of blue light blocking lenses if you already have glasses at any eyeglass place.
That's cool. Well, so then tell me, feel free to name the brand. Was it Amazon or where did you acquire it? How could we all?
Yeah, it was Amazon. I typed in, you know, computer light blocking glasses, and you know, there's some that are more expensive. And actually there was a company that was on Shark Tank last week that's got another pair of glasses. I think theirs are like $50 or $60. I honestly don't know what the difference is. My $8 ones are fabulous. So try them out. I mean, I don't know that they're the most fashionable, but try them out. And if you want to upgrade, you know, upgrade later.
Oh, that's excellent. Thank you. All right, cool. Well, now could you share with us a favorite habit, you know, personal practice of yours that's really been helpful?
Yeah, I've got a few. I try to meditate in the mornings. I'm not great about it. You know, they say you're supposed to do it before coffee, and I really like having coffee first thing. So I'm getting better at practicing meditation in the morning, but the practice I really want to share is a creativity practice. And so I've got about a 30-minute drive to this startup that I work at now. And my old morning routine would be to wake up, you know, consume some online news, and then start listening to podcasts. And I would probably listen to, you know, 2, 3, 4 podcasts in the morning, all, you know, sped up 1.5 times. And I'd get to work and I'd be, you know, a little bit on edge. I'd be stressed out. It's like, oh, I didn't get through all my podcasts. I'm listening to, you know, fast voices all morning long. It really wasn't the most relaxing start to the day. And, you know, you and I were both podcast professionals. We got to listen to a lot of podcasts and know what's going on out there. But so I still listen to podcasts in the morning, but for a piece of my commute now, I don't listen to podcasts and I turn off the radio and I sit in silence in my car as I drive to work. And this is going to sound really funny, but I look at things on the side of the road, or you know, that I see, and I see a dog on the side of the road, and I'll start to make up a story about that dog, you know, out loud in my car. I'll say that dog is named Frisky, and Frisky came on a boat here from China, and on that boat he made a friend. And so, you know, I start to do this, and Pete, stay with me. This sounds crazy, but now when I get to work, I feel like my creativity and my original thinking capabilities are really firing on all cylinders. And it's, you know, it's been an interesting way to cut back on a lot of the stress that I have in the morning and start these creative juices flowing. You know, it wasn't long ago where we didn't have smartphones and we weren't filling every single second of our time being in front of a screen, being entertained. You know, we used to have quiet time with alone with ourselves. Now we rarely have that. And I think our minds need an outlet for the creativity. I think we all have creativity and creative juices pumping through us, but we need to manifest this and we need to practice those and we need an outlet for them. And, you know, by sitting quietly for 5-10 minutes, kind of similar to meditating, I let those creative juices flow, and the results have been pretty cool.
That is intriguing. Well, it's funny, as you tell a Frisky story, it just brings a smile to my face. And it just seems like a pleasant way to live life, in the sense of you're noticing things and then you're allowing the brain to play a little bit. And in so doing, that just makes sense. That as a natural outcome of that is more free flow and creative thought.
Yeah, you know, I'm looking forward to having kids, because then I won't be a crazy person telling stories to myself in the car. I can make up stories for my kids, and I think that'll be a great outlet for it.
That's cool. And is there a particular nugget or piece of insight that you share that really seems to connect and resonate with folks that they maybe repeat it back to you?
Yeah, I mean, it just kind of harkens back to the not taking no. You know, it's really just what I said before, is that you're not going to get what you don't ask for. And, you know, everyone's just trying to have their best and most happy path through life, trying to help others where they can. And, you know, this is a good way to achieve that.
And Alex, if folks want to learn more or get in touch, where would you point them?
Yeah, I'd point them to the podcast, wallstreetoasis.com. You'll find the podcast there. And, you know, I'd love to hear, you know, any questions as well. You can email me, alex@wallstreetoasis.com. Happy to help and anything that I can do.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you. And do you have a final challenge or call to action you'd share to folks seeking to be awesome at their jobs?
Yep. I would say the rejection therapy, do it for 30 days. You'll be amazed by what comes of it. Like I said in the beginning, it's very, very, very difficult. And by the end, you will be walking up to strangers in bars, asking them for God knows what, but you'll have the confidence and humility that you never thought you would have before.
That's awesome. Well, Alex, thank you so much for taking the time here. I wish you tons of luck with the podcast and your fundraising and your storytelling and future child rearing and all you're up to.
Pete, thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
I really loved Alex's take that if you keep asking and going through this process, you become more humble. And then as a result, you kind of realize that no one really cares that much when it comes to you asking, and you think it's a big deal, but it's really not. And they're more concerned with themselves and what they're up to. I think it's just a powerful reframe if you're ever getting a little bit caught up in sort of self-conscious. And there's like, hey, you know what? There's a great quote along the lines of, we would care little about how others thought about us if we realized how seldom they did so. Something like that. It's one of my mom's favorites. And it connects with me. It resonates here in the context of asking. It's not a big deal. People aren't freaked out, worried. You can say, can you believe this person asked it? No, it's all good. And it's a lot of fun to go there. Just sort of see what happens and make a game of it with that rejection therapy. So much good stuff there. Again, if you want to check out the transcript or the links to pieces that we mentioned here, it's over at awesomeatyourjob.com/F276. If you haven't already, I hope you'll push subscribe. You'll hear from our next guest. It is Danny Dover. And Danny made quite a splash with his TED Talk about how he accomplished his entire bucket list. And he's learned a thing or two along the way about goal setting, goal achieving, and how that's done well. So I hope to catch you there. In peace.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode. To get the most out of this conversation, visit awesomeatyourjob.com to find today's show notes, transcript, and infographic summary cheat sheet. For more entertaining professional skill sharpening, be sure to subscribe to catch the next episode of How to Be Awesome at Your Job.